It's nice to be here. And we're a smaller number today, I guess, because of the holiday, but more people than I thought came. I've said this many times before, I'm often surprised when I open my eyes and see how many people are here after I've closed. So what I had in mind today was, if I can manage not to talk so much, is to talk just a little bit, kind of set a theme, and then have more of a discussion or have some kind of discussion some way or other, if that's agreeable with all of you. And what I wanted to do, kind of the theme that's been on my mind since yesterday, is the theme of renunciation. And so I'll start off by reading this quote or poem by the Buddha from the Dharmapada. And you can have this kind of in the back of your mind as we go through this. So the Buddha said, "If by giving up a limited happiness, one would see abundant happiness, let the wise, beholding abundant happiness, give up the limited happiness, the limited pleasure." So would you be willing to give up a limited pleasure for happiness, for an abundant happiness? So I went up yesterday to visit Ajahn Amaro. Ajahn means teacher, and Amaro is the monk's name of an Englishman who was ordained as a Thai monk. He's a student of, disciple of Ajahn Sumedho. And, you know, he's from the Theravada tradition. He's kind of in our wider tradition. He's part of our family. And he's just started a monastery up in Ukiah, in Redwood Valley. They have about 250 acres up there. And there's now two monks and several lay people and a postulant, a man who's planning at some point becoming a monk. And about five of us went up to visit them and had a meeting with them and look around. And it's a beautiful piece of property. It's this, it's kind of in this hillside, this forested hillside. They're forest monks, so they got themselves a forest. It's convenient. And it's this madrone, oak, chaparral, poison oak kind of vegetation. And two of us came late, so we missed the walk. They went for a 3-hour walk around the property, coming back, talking about all the poison oak they walked through, and they pulled out the technu, and we're trying to get them to get it off. And it's a kind of a, going to be, I think, probably a thriving monastic center here in California. Ajahn Amaro is a wonderful teacher. He's going to come and teach for us here in Palo Alto in January for a one-day sitting. And in some ways, the Theravada and Buddhism as a wider religious tradition than just Vipassana, monasticism is one of the important elements in the big puzzle, the mandala of what's scene is like. Not that it's expected any of us will become monks, but it's part of the mandala of the tradition. And so we were up there talking about all kinds of things, and at some point he started praising the virtues of monasticism. After all, he's a monk. He loves what he does, and so he loves talking about it, I guess. And he was talking about how talking about monasticism in a sense, maybe part of it is like it's an archetype. Or part of it is being a monk or a nun is there's a part of each of us that has a monastic streak, or there's a monastic aspect, he said, to every human being. And there's many other aspects also, but it's one part of who we are. Not that we have to turn that into being a monk or a nun, but it's part of who we are, is a monastic side. And he talked about how, for him, that living the monastic life was not giving up all kinds of wonderful things, but for him it was a giving up of limited happiness for abundant happiness. And that there's a certain way, he talked about the life force, that the life force that courses through us, that we're somehow responsible for how it gets channeled through us, that for him the life force was channeled most efficiently, most beautifully, most virtuously, most as it should be, in the form of monasticism. And that whatever streak we have within us that's monastic is one of the streaks, one of the ways in which this life force can go through. So he was kind of switching back and forth between that's something all of us have that's beautiful and should be tapped into from time to time, and something that you can actually do as a form. You can become a monk or a nun, and it's a really beautiful thing to do. And in the Buddhist tradition, the theme, also renunciation is then a big part usually of becoming a monk. The word for renunciation in Pali, nekkhamma, comes from the root of the word to leave home or to leave or to depart. Home leaving is what is used for describing becoming a monk or a nun. And then part of the, kind of the other side often of renunciation is the idea of contentment, being content. And renunciation should be a life of contentment, or going towards contentment should arise out of contentment rather than rising out of discontentment and therefore reacting or responding to discontentment and going from one life of discontent to another life of discontent, a greater life of discontent. And it's an interesting question to explore, you know, how much of our life is run by discontent? You know, are you discontented with your life in some ways? Or are you discontented with parts of your life and who you are? And is that discontentment then responsible for certain decisions you make for what you do with your time and people you're involved in, the work you do? And I think that in the Vipassana tradition in the West, we're a lay tradition. Most of the students are lay. Most of the teachers are lay. And so we don't talk much about things like renunciation or letting go so much or surrender or sacrifice or disenchantment or monastic life itself. And so it might be interesting just to look a little bit at why we don't talk about these words that are words that are a little bit more popularly used in the tradition than we hear in the West. And part of it, I think, is because it's a little bit offensive to some of our ears. If I sat up here every Monday evening and talked, you know, renounce, 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 you know, there'd only be a few diehards left. I'd be talking to myself. But it seems kind of offensive or disagreeable to many of us, to our Western sentiments. And I think there's a kind of strong feeling in the West, kind of affirmation of life, or, you know, America, the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness is like, you know, a God-given right that we all have. And anything that's going to get in the way of my pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness is what's the word in English? Antheme? Anatomy?
Anathema.
You know, is that the right word?
Yes.
And so get out of my way. So renunciation, that seems kind of frightening to this idea of let's affirm life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, it seems dangerous. You know, you can't get what you deserve then. You know, that's the latest version of that. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and give me what I deserve. So it kind of rings a little bit against kind of some of the undercurrents of how Americans want to kind of, American philosophy, the American views and values. But I think because of that, I think it's often interesting to look then at the underside of that, or the shadow side of that. Why is this reluctance somehow to talk about renunciation or letting go or surrender or monasticism or whatever? Because maybe you haven't felt it, but I felt this kind of hesitation, or this, it's disagreeable to bring this up too much. Now it occurred to me recently that many of the Vipassana students in the West end up living monastic lives, but they don't know it. And we don't tell you. We don't tell you, you know, come sign up for a 10-day retreat and, you know, and do a 10-day monastic retreat where you become a monk for a nun for 10 days. You take vows of celibacy for 10 days. You eat only what's pretty much given you for 10 days. You don't get to choose your food. You follow the schedule. You have to keep silence. There's, you know, it's basically a monastic life, and you have to come to a monastery usually to do it, because usually monasteries where we do the retreats. And so we don't say, you know, sign up for the, you know, come be a nun or a monk for 10 days. I don't know, maybe none of you would go. We say, come and do a Vipassana retreat, you know, and be with your favorite teacher and have a nice time. But it's, you know, a lot of it has to do with words and the words we choose to describe things. You know, there's many different ways of describing the same thing. maybe instead of renunciation, we can talk about simplicity, and then people would perk up a little bit more, rather than kind of, you know, if I say renunciation, the energy drops. But simplicity, oh, that seems okay. So partly it's a choice of words, but, you know, so I think one of the forms that American Vipassana practice is taking, because it's so lay-centered, is that actually we go back and forth between temporary monastic practice, temporary monasticism, and then living our practice in daily life. And it works very well to kind of go back and forth. But you don't have to think about it being monastic if you don't want. And also this word, disenchantment is another word that's kind of key to the Buddha, to the Theravada tradition. And disenchantment, Jesus, you know, I don't want to, what, you know, that sounds kind of world-renouncing or world-disaffirming. I don't want anything to do with disenchantment. I want to be enchanted. But, so I want to give two examples, one dramatic and one more subtle. And the dramatic one I just make up, but, you know, we all know, maybe living examples. You know, the Silicon Valley executive who works 80 hours a week and has a car and three cellular phones, probably two cars, probably has a Lexus set up, you know. and has several houses and has a nice husband with many kids and has, you know, all everything, right? But doesn't have herself. Because, you know, working so hard, trying to do all these different things, reaching out, grabbing, trying to have everything, trying to have too much. Now, someone who's living that life and constantly pursuing money and more money to have more things and all that stuff and jockeying it all, if that person was disenchanted with their life, we'd be kind of happy to hear that. You know, we're all kind of disenchanted, I think, with that kind of life already. It doesn't seem interesting to us, that kind of intense kind of life of greed and having more and success and working hard, I suspect. I've talked to people, you know, who've renounced the life of Wall Street. They've been in the financial world for a number of years and renounced it. Enough of this. It's killing me. And so they go off to find something else, a life of renunciation. They said, you know, a life of simplicity. But it's just a matter of how we choose the words, perhaps. So the more subtle example. So we were up there visiting Ajahnamurro, and part of the scene around monks. Monks and nuns aren't allowed to go out and buy their own food. They're not allowed to store their own food overnight. They're not allowed to cook their own food. So whatever food they're going to eat that day has to be given to them. And so usually if they're in a place where it's appropriate, they go walking for an alms rounds carrying their bowl. But up there in Redwood Valley in Ukiah, you know, you know, they're going to have to walk for a long time. So what happens is that when lay people come to visit the monastery, one of the things then, you know, the lay people are concerned, these monks, the monks up there, there's no nuns right now, so they're concerned these monks, you know, they should survive somehow, so you want to bring them some food. So there's a whole thing where you bring food and you serve them their meal and they have their meal, and it's a very nice ceremony, it's nice to support them. And so the five of us all brought food, and I brought a lot of food, but I didn't cook anything that was particular to that meal. I brought three melons, which could have been cut up and offered for that meal, but they could have been kept for the next day, because the monks can't store food, but the lay people who are there, they can store the food and then serve it to the monks the next day. So I bought these melons, I brought a whole bunch of apple juice, I brought these boxes of crackers and spaghetti sauce, and things that, you know, didn't have to be eaten that day. So I just brought it, you know, I didn't think about it too much. I gave it to the kitchen, and so they have it there. So it was time for the meal, and there were all these dishes that everybody had brought. And then they had this custom up there of when they offered a dish, the main cook who in the kitchen, she would announce who that dish was from. So, you know, my dish was nowhere to be seen. My melons hadn't been cut up. Everybody else is having their name announced. They made this donation. And Gil, you know, it's, what a miser. And then at some point in the middle of the meal, I'd come with this woman. The person said, and now this dish comes from Nancy and Gil. And I had to say, well, actually, no. I had to announce the fact that it didn't come from me. So, you know, here I was, you know, so these thoughts, you know, oh, you know, now they're going to think I'm a miser, and, you know, now I'm not so generous, and I don't know the scene. I've been a monk myself, I should have known, and they probably think maybe I don't respect them enough, and I'm just, or I'm freeloading, I'm getting, because afterwards you get to eat whatever's left over, and there's usually lots of food, so it's like, so you get freeloading, you know, they're going to think all these terrible thoughts of me, and see me terribly, and I, you know, maybe I should say something, you know, and I should make announce, well, you know, actually, I brought these melons and apple juice, you know, and but then I brought things just to make sure they knew, and so I wouldn't, you know, so they would have the right image of me, right? So I'm sure that none of you kind of really understand how it's this dilemma of self-image and protecting it and putting it out there. But anyway, there I was in this world wondering what, you know, this is awkward. So, you know, and it was a little bit more subtle than working 80 hours a week and pursuing lots of money or whatever, but it's kind of pursuing something similar. So that at some point, and I noticed it well enough, that this is ridiculous. And so I renounced it. I gave it up. I surrendered that. You know, I surrendered not because, not so much because it was silly, but I surrendered because it wasn't who I really am, who I really was. It wasn't really expressing the deeper sense of contentment, of fullness, of openness to the world, of non-protectedness or non-defensiveness or non-projectionness that I feel is who I really am. You don't have to be anybody to be a great person. Isn't that great? Isn't that a relief? So I could just set, I started renouncing in that situation, was renouncing and settling back into this being that didn't have to be anybody. And it was kind of a great relief. So there are two kinds of renunciation. There's that kind of renunciation which is a release. It's a kind of release of all those things that keep us from our contentment, keep us from our wholeness. It's a kind of a renunciation that reveals maybe the luminous quality of our life, the luminous quality of awareness or presence itself. It's the release of those things which gets in the way from us being the best person that we could be. And isn't that great to renounce the things that are in the way of letting us be the best person we can be? It seems like a nice thing to do. The other kind of renunciation is that which diminishes our life. You renounce something and it diminishes the quality of our life. It hurts us in some way. It hurts our inner sense of integrity. So it can augment our integrity or it can decrease it. And it's for us to decide, you know, what is appropriate in this situation. I think of renunciation not to get away from something, but to get into life more fully. There was another monk I talked to at one point who talked about the value of monasticism being, look, you know, you live this worldly life and you have to go shopping and cooking and make money and pay mortgage and do all this stuff and your life is just a mess and it's just complicated. And you become a monk and people cook for you, they bring you food and you can just hang out and it's just very simple and it's very nice, you don't have to think about all these problems. And it's, you know, you really focus on your spiritual life. And that's one way of thinking about it. But there's another way also of thinking about it. And that is, you know, cooking and shopping and paying your mortgage and all these things. Rather than getting rid of them, maybe there's a way of renouncing a certain attitude we have about them that allows us to enter into more fully so it becomes, you know, as much of a monastic practice as sweeping the temple. The monks, they were sweeping the temple all the time. They didn't think that sweeping a temple got in their way. Why should washing the dishes or going shopping get in your way? It has to do with an attitude of what you bring, how you bring to it. And if we're trying to do 20 things at once, maybe then, you know, it's too much. Maybe renunciation then is at least do two things, if not just one. Renunciation is simplifying our life enough just to be able to be there fully and make this a practice, make this a place where we enter into life, rather than make us fragmented. So I looked up renunciation today in the dictionary to look at the etymological root. And so the re part means like back. But the enunciation part is like the word announce or enunciate. It means to tell, to speak. And so it's to speak back or to repeat, I guess, or re-say. And there's something about saying that comes with renunciation, at least in the classic. Have you ever noticed the kind of release that can come when you're honest? You say something, you say your truth to someone or to yourself, and you can feel it's a release in your body. You know, to renounce allows for a certain kind of release. And I think that healthy renunciation requires a kind of truth-saying, a kind of honesty about what's going on, who we are. And you need to be extremely honest for renunciation to be an appropriate thing in our life. Sacrifice literally means, this Latin word, literally means to make sacred. You know, if you go to your corporation and work, and your boss says, well, you have to sacrifice for your job and work a few extra hours today, is that making sacred? Maybe, depends again your attitude, but I think we use the word sacred. Sacrifice has lost its original meaning. But is there sacredness in your life? And is there some way you can sacrifice, make sacred? Is there some way we can renounce or give up? Give up originally meant to offer up, so that if something becomes sacred or connects us to what's sacred, rather than becomes a kind of diminishment of who we are. So what can we renounce? And classic things like material gain, goods, possessions. Self-importance. We can renounce the urge to dominate others. We can renounce the need to control others. We can renounce the need to be effective or to be in control. We can renounce the need to be right. Wouldn't that be a relief if all of us could renounce the need to be right? You can still be right. But renouncing the need to be right, right? We can renounce our hesitation. We can renounce our fear. We can renounce all our excuses. What about that? So to renounce. And then we can renounce our self-concepts. You know, so my image of myself as being, you know, the most generous person in the world, you know, I have to renounce that image. Why bother having it? So maybe that's enough, so we can have some discussion. Suzuki Roshi said, renunciation is not giving up the things of this world, but accepting that they go away. Mm. Isn't that something? Mm. Accepting they go away. And the other side of renunciation is contentment. A content person is not concerned with building up possessions or building up a self-image with reputations. This content person is not acting with those kinds of needs. The content person doesn't try to control the situation, control other people. So we can start with contentment. You know, or discontentment, if that's what's going on. It's very important to start, what is discontentment? What is it like to be content in one's body? To have physical, bodily contentment? If we use our body as a standard, and say, well, I'm going to live a life, at least my body is content. It's very hard to have our minds racing along at 100 miles an hour doing 100 different things at once. The body is a great truth-telling device. So to ask yourself, you know, do I have a content body? Or discover some modicum of contentment, perhaps, in your meditation practice or some other activity that you do. To take that very, very seriously. And use that contentment as a not as something to judge yourself by, but rather as a reference point to notice when you lose your contentment, to what causes the loss of contentment, and what helps you become more content in a holistic way, in a useful way. So, yes.
A lot of them seem to be ideas, and then you said fear.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a totally different kind of thing and much harder to renounce.
Yes. But sometimes we can, and sometimes it may be appropriate. Sometimes you can see something like fear, and you can struggle for years, you know, figuring it out and trying to do something with it, trying to, you know, cope with it, whatever. And sometimes, I'm not saying always, but sometimes it's possible I should just give it up.
Letting go.
Yeah, letting go, renunciation, surrender.
Instead of
giving up, simplifying yourself. A lot of it has to do with words, and so it's a matter of finding the right word for you. But asking your question about fear, this is changing a little bit, but I had a friend who went to her meditation teacher, and was complaining, I guess, a little bit about how difficult her life was and how she was doing so many different things. And I'm feeling very fragmented, doing all these different things at once. And all the various demands and projects. And her teacher said, "Oh, that's the lazy way." And she thought, she's like, "Well, what?" You know, she's busting her ass, you know, and he's completely exhausted from doing all this stuff. And the teacher said, "That's the lazy way." And so she's thought about it for a long time. What was that about? And after some months, she realized, actually, for her, it was the lazy way, because by being busy all the time, she never had to look deeply at herself. And so it was actually a kind of escape from herself. And that was the easy thing. That was the lazy thing, was to stay busy. So for her, it was to give up her laziness. Yes?
In addressing why, you know, we tend to, at least for myself, I tend to, you know, not like the word monk, and yet living simply feels totally fine. It has to do with association with organized religion. And, you know, my fear of organized religion, the moment you enter into it, all of a sudden there's a lack of questioning. And that's my biggest problem with the whole, you know, once you start fitting into a structure like that.
Good. That's a good fear. Yes.
Last week you spoke about contentment being one of the prerequisites for, I guess, for further study.
It classically, contentment and friendship are the precursor for the Eightfold Path. Yes, of course.
In the world. Not discontentment necessarily with yourself, but discontentment with the state of the way things are.
Well, this is a matter of, you know, it's a matter of, you know, words and definitions and all this, what we actually mean. But I think we start just with ourselves. I mean, a lot of social activists have found that they haven't been much use when they're coming from acting themselves from a place of discontentment. They could, the world was, you know, something's wrong with the world that had to be addressed. And so they went to address it. But you know, they would get angry, they'd get upset. I mean, all these nonviolent activists who then fight with each other. You know, if we start, at least it's possible to act in the world with the contentment, even with tremendous passion to take care of things. But at least you can be settled on yourself. That's possible. I think so, yeah. We need to take care of the world, I think. It's very important. Yes?
You spoke of monasticism as leaving home. And I think in my own case, home was a place I really, really did not want to leave. My family was there, and yet I saw that being at home made me kind of crazy, because though I loved my mother and father, my sister loved them, still, their assumptions about the world, or their values, or beliefs, or way of doing things, just kind of was driving me crazy. So, if finally, I thought I would renounce home and leave home. And think I want to join a Buddhist family or the values, not even beliefs, but the way of life of the Sangha, because that little bit of happiness that I had in the craziness of my nuclear family could be replaced by joining the tradition of homelessness that these monks that you talked about in Nikaya have started to have continued to work. So I can see how, in my own case, this longing to renounce something might lead to a real marriage to the world or engagement with something more valuable and more satisfying.
So yeah, I think many people have found that, someone once said that when you join a formally like a Buddhist family, like as a monk or a nun, or you enter like a Buddhist community and live there, it's kind of like entering a family, and you're joining a family. And someone once said, hopefully that family is more functional than your home, than your original family. And there's been plenty of dysfunctional Buddhist families too. But it's interesting, in the years that I spent at San Francisco Zen Center and some other Buddhist communities, there was a lot of alienated youths who joined, who came for a while and were estranged from their family, estranged from their local neighborhoods and communities, and were maybe running away or maybe rebelling against it, or just didn't get along with their family. It was very painful to go back and visit. And what was remarkable was that as people practiced over the years, that rather than being continuing to be home leavers, they actually learned a new kind of connectedness to the world, to the neighborhood, to their friends, to society, and to their family. And actually their Buddhist involvement, rather than being a leaving of home, actually allowed them to come back in a healthier way. And then one more thing I'll say just my own life. When I was first living like a monk, before I was ordained, but living at the San Francisco Zen Center, living at Green Gulch in Tassajara, I was just becoming a beginning monk. I began seeing very clearly how my mind worked and all the trips, psychological trips that I lived, And this thing about the food offering, that was minor compared to what I used to go on in there, right? Or still goes on, but that was just... I started seeing all this stuff, and I didn't want to be part of it anymore. I said, I can renounce this. I don't have to, I'm not going to buy into my own trips. I'm going to find another way of living. But the sad thing was that I had a girlfriend back then, and I could see those similar kind of her head trips, her egotistical trips or whatever. And I didn't have any patience for it because I was a whole new world of not living on all these trips that opened up to me. And I wasn't that I was anyway. I wasn't cruel with her. But I simply wouldn't meet her at those needs that she had. And I look back some years later and feeling regretful that I had some wisdom, but I hadn't learned the compassion for her situation. So that wisdom kept me actually kind of aloof from her situation, understanding it. And after I practiced more years, I had the compassion, but then she was long gone. Yes?
I have a question about... I'm finding it hard to see a difference. As you were speaking, a fragment of one of the Cold Mountain poems came into mind. I carry this sword of knowledge to cut down senseless craving. And I've been thinking about how we see ourselves, I see myself crave something. And then there's that moment of, shall I do it? Shall I just sit, shall I just watch myself crave? But that's not the same as renouncing, is it?
Right.
It's a different activity. And I wonder where the line is between just seeing craving for what it is and simply renouncing a thing.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think each person has to decide. You understand the question? So each person, I think, has to decide for themselves. Mindfulness itself is just noticing very clearly what's going on. If you can notice well enough, if you really bring a lot of careful observation, really, really honest observation of what's going on, if something needs to be let go of, it'll let go of itself. It's really beautiful, powerful, the way mindfulness is. So you be extremely honest. You don't have to do the letting go. Rather, you can allow the situation to take care of itself, and the appropriate thing will happen usually if you have enough time and enough observation. But we don't just live in a world of observation and time. We also live in a world where we have to act and do things. And it's just, you know, if it's really obvious and easy to pull out a splinter, you know, if you just wait long enough and watch long enough, the splinter's body will kind of push the splinter out. But it's, you know, it's kind of silly, isn't it? Not just simply reach down and pull it out. So the same way this way is, you know, if it's easy to renounce or give up something, and you can do it in a healthy way, which with understanding and honesty and clarity, without aversion or hate towards anything, it's very valuable, very wise to use a sword of wisdom to say, enough of this. Enough is enough. I'm not going to do this anymore, or stop, I'm going to stop this, or renounce it. The danger with the language of renunciation or letting go is that people sometimes let go too easily or too quickly or too fast, too easily. And the letting go, either things which are inappropriate to let go of, or the letting go so quickly they don't understand the dynamics that cause the very situation to begin with. So if you're very good at letting go of your anger, for example, you know, Buddhism gets great at letting go of anger. And it comes up again, and they let go of it. It's great. And it comes up again, and let go of it. But they don't have a clue what are the conditions that bring it, that out of which it arises to begin with. So if you let go too much and don't hang out with something for a while and get to know it, you might not be able to understand the roots of it. So it's you're the one who decides where the line is.
It's two different things, isn't it?
How so?
Understanding the roots of it and letting go of it.
Yes, two different things.
I guess I was
wondering
if perhaps one is preemptive, whereas the other is ongoing.
What do you mean?
Well, if I say, I renounce driving, I won't use an automobile.
Yeah.
That's preemptive. I will never use, I mean, as long as I am faithful to this vow of renunciation.
Yeah.
Whereas if I just think about it each and every time, it's an ongoing process.
Oh, I see.
It's a different, perhaps that's a difference.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so some things it's possible to just renounce and through that clear renunciation, especially if you do it in a serious vow, or you do a serious vow with a friend or with a teacher or something, it can have a big impact in your life, and it informs who you are, and it's very hard then to pick that up again. You know, you renounce alcohol, you renounce gambling, or you renounce, and you know, and you do it with enough ceremony, enough intention, and it's very hard then to find yourself breaking that. But if you renounce lying, well, pretty soon you realize it's just getting pretty subtle. You know, what's lying and what's not, and that vow to renounce lying, that situation becomes more the vow to look very carefully at one's speech, an attempt to understand what is lying and what isn't, and to renounce it whenever it comes up. So there it becomes an ongoing process. But sometimes there isn't much of a root behind something, and it's just easy to decide to let go of it. You're not really denying your opportunity to look at the root. It's just enough. I mean, sometimes in meditation, you know, you're sitting there and your mind just is thinking about the same silly thing over and over and over again, you know, and it just, you know, you're thinking about pizzas, you know, and different flavors of pizza and new menus for pizzas and how you could put pineapple on and, you know, whatever. You know, you're sitting there. Sometimes it's best just to say, enough, you know, and just use a sword of wisdom and say, stop. And that's, you don't have to sit there watching yourself make pizzas.
Do you know why?
Why? You might not know why, but maybe you don't want to know why. Francis.
In that moment when you are observing, aren't you then renouncing a the old reaction to the object?
If yes, if the observation, if the mindfulness is clear enough in that it's in the moment of mindfulness, clear mindfulness, there's no grasping. That's what the tradition says, and that's kind of what my experience has been. But you have to really bring that moment of clear mindfulness, discover what that is. And then, if you can keep those moments of clear mindfulness up through time, something really remarkable can happen, because you're letting go of the chain of clinging which supports and creates much of our life. So yes. Bill.
Talking about giving up automobiles and giving up things and are giving up things by looking at the root of them. But last November, for no particular reason that I can particularly state at the moment, I stopped driving my car to work and started riding my bicycle to the train and taking the train down to Santa Clara and then riding my bike to work, partly because of exercise and other things. One of the things that I immediately discovered was that driving to work made me crazy. When I got to work, I was relaxed and I could deal with the day a whole lot better than if I had spent. Took me longer to get to work, but by the time I got there, I was a lot more relaxed. So now, I don't like if for some reason I'm forced to drive my car to work, like I'm sick or I have an errand or something like that. It's very hard for me to do. I don't want to do it anymore because I don't like to.
So it's a healthy, kind of healthy version of renunciation. Right. You realize that by renouncing the car, it benefits your life. What are some of the things that you all have renounced in your life that's been a healthy and useful and thing to have done? Or what are some of the things you'd like to renounce? Yes?
I've got a question about that. The 3-day retreat in the summer, at the end of that retreat, I came back down and I had one cup of coffee. And I haven't had any coffee since, because over the course of that retreat, you know, I had the traditional retreat caffeine headache. And I don't know why I stopped drinking coffee, and I don't know that it's particularly done anything for me, but I don't want to start again. It's just one of those things that I stopped doing and I can't sit here and articulate why. I just did it. And it doesn't feel like a wrong thing or a right thing, but that's not the situation with the car where I renunciated the car and then I discovered that it was a great thing that I did. This is just, I just quit.
So that's an interesting distinction between, renunciation has to be a choice mm-hmm. rather than just an evolution of what happens naturally. So let's hear, I'd like to hear, we have just a couple of minutes maybe, some of you can just say, what are some of the things that you've renounced, or what are some things you'd like to renounce? Yes?
I think renunciation is a very heavy word, and I think that it's hard to put that word onto things you sort of stop doing sometimes.
Uh-huh.
So I would have trouble saying that this was a renunciation.
Okay. Yes.
I think these were some wonderful examples of the way in which making vows is, for me at least, is always counterproductive. If I make a vow to do something, it becomes that much better. If I take a vow that I'm going to ride my bike to work, the car becomes that much more fun to drive. In all cases where I've successfully renounced something, it's never been because I said, I want to renounce driving to work. It's always been as a ratification of something that evolved naturally,
uh-huh.
in which I just got sick and tired of, you know, changing oil in my car because I was driving it so much, or because I got sick and tired of something that was a consequence of doing something else. And if I do those things mindfully enough and I understand those causes and effects, then I just give up.
Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty good. You know, I talked about two different ways of renouncing, and one way was renounce where it connects you to some something that's important for you. So in Bill's situation, you know, he renounced the car, if we want to use that word, because there was something greater, a greater happiness that was obvious to him, and so he was going towards a greater happiness. And but if you just renounce because you heard it's a good idea to renounce, and you don't really understand the benefits of that renunciation, maybe it won't work so easily. But if you really see for yourself, you know, the benefits and how it really is greater happiness for you, then maybe it's easier.
I think the word renunciation is dangerous because Buddhism is hedonism. We're here for the maximum pleasure, right?
Buddhism is?
Buddhism is hedonism.
You could maximum happiness. Maximum pleasure.
Maybe we're using the same two different words for the same thing. But we're the idea of giving up small pleasures that get in the way of a larger pleasure. We're giving up small happinesses that get in the way of larger happiness. And so in that sense we should just I see that you give up those small things as little steps along the way to getting something better. But until you see where you're going, you don't make those steps.
So what's the greatest happiness?
I don't know. I haven't got there yet.
What do you think it is for you?
For me, it's one of the things I'm very conscious of is that I see things and I want them. And there are a number of kinds of things that I
see. The greatest happiness that you know?
When I'm doing something and I don't care.
And you don't care?
I'm just doing it and I'm enjoying it.
So it's doing things without self-consciousness?
I may even be conscious of myself, but I don't particularly care whether I'm conscious of myself.
Uh-huh.
It's doing things without concern.
Thank you. So maybe one more, then we can go home. Yes, no. Margaret.
That reminded me. So, what I try to do sometimes when I shop is if I see something, you know, there's immediately, oh, I want that. Sometimes I catch myself and say to myself, well, do I really need that? Yeah, and so it's kind of a momentary, I guess, renunciation of certain things. Because there's this impulse to, you know, to get this. This will make me happy, you know. I settle back. No, I don't really need that. I just pass it up.
And sometimes realizing that the happiness we want from the things is not going to come from that anyway. Sometimes you get it, and then 2 days later, let's go to the store again.
Yeah, see something.
Yes.
I bet there's lots of people here, myself included, who have given up cigarettes. I'm amazed when people smoke now, because I think so many people, my generation anyway, we all smoke. It's very easy to give it up in the sense of understanding what the health detriments were. And as I was thinking about this, I gave it up, but I've also had the occasional cigarette since I gave it up, which, does that mean I gave it up or I didn't give it up? I don't know. It's not the same sort of thing as it was. And I think many people.
So you've given up the addiction, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
But you haven't, you know. Maybe that's the important thing, is the addiction, not the thing itself. Mm-hmm. Maybe one more. Let me just.
I don't know either whether I can use the word renunciate or not, but I stopped doing a lucrative profession and well-respected profession, and so gave up both the doing of it, the respect for it that I got from it, the money that I got from it, and the identity, certain amount of identity that came from doing it.
Maybe it's not appropriate to say this completely, but you'll forgive me, I'm sure. The full appreciation of that renunciation took a while for you to learn, right?
Yes, in the sense that I think that there were subtleties of it that I wasn't aware of. I wasn't aware of ways I was identified with it until I left it. So the appreciation for not being less and less identified with that. And same thing with the financial aspects of it. There were things I wasn't conscious of, but it became conscious of this And I also gave up TV and wrote.
So, anyway, so the word renunciation is, you know, somewhat a problematic term, and we can probably manage a spiritual life quite well without this word. And there's other ways of doing this, you know, talking about the same thing, you know, just a matter of the words we choose. I think it's well worth thinking about a little bit. What could you renounce so that you can be more content in your life? What stands in the way of your deep contentment, or what stands in the way of your happiness, or what stands in the way of your connection with life and other people? Is there something that you can let go of and give up in a simple way so that you become more fully who you are? So you might think about it. So thank you all.
Thank you.